Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, December 2nd, 2018. This is episode 1546. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/techguy. And by Prilock Security. Teach your employees how to keep your company secure by avoiding phishing emails, candy drops, and social engineering. Show them how and why hackers attack with training from Prilock Security. Go to prilock.com/twit and use the promo code Leo to save 30%. And by Brex, the first corporate credit card for startups. Get the card free and Twit listeners get Brex card fees waived forever at brex.com/twit. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Good to see you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Oh, yeah, it's tech guy time. Yeah, your worst nightmare, a geek with his own radio show. We talk on this show about, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. In fact, Chris Marquardt will be joining us in a couple of hours to talk about getting better pictures with your smartphone or your fancy camera, if you've got one of those. We also talk about smartphones and smartwatches, augmented reality, that kind of thing. Anything with a chip in it. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. I had a caller named Chip yesterday. I said, oh, you fit the show. Anything with a chip in it. I don't think he didn't get it or he wasn't amused. But anyway, anything with a microprocessor in it. How about that? 8888-ASK-LEO is my phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Did you do some shopping on Cyber Monday and, last week's Black Friday? I was surprised to see that actually the biggest, one of the biggest days was Thanksgiving Day. People spent on Thanksgiving Day online on their phones, not computers, but on their phones, $1 billion. And I'm trying to think of this. This is, by the way, a big increase, I think more than 20% from Thanksgiving Day of last year. And I'm trying to think what's going on. And I think it's like people, everybody now lives on their smartphone, right? That's all you see all the time is somebody looking at their smartphones all the time. Just looking. So I figured this is what's happening. You're going to Thanksgiving. People are stuffed. They've had it with the family. They don't want to talk anymore. The football game's on. So they sit down, pull out their phone, right? And they think, I should probably see if there's any holiday deals. $3.7 billion total spent on Thanksgiving Day. That's 28% increase from the year before. The number one product on Turkey Day, Nintendo Switch, number one. Oh, now I see the psychology. You're sitting there, you're bored to tears. You're thinking, if I only had a handheld game system that I could just pull out of my pocket, I wouldn't be so bored. Number two, Beats headphones. Oh, same thing. If I just had some good headphones, I could listen to some music instead of let Uncle Joe go on and on about whatever. Number three, I don't know what this is. Maybe this is a hot item this holiday season. Hot Wheels? Hot Wheels? Those were big when I was a kid. Hot Wheels? They're back. A video game was number four. And I think, again, the idea of committing mayhem on one's relatives stimulated Red Dead Redemption 2. And then finally, Hatchababies. Which I've never heard of, but is obviously the holiday gift of the year. Isn't there one every year? One, and it's often some sort of, I should Google this, some sort of technology. Hatchy babies. I'm guessing. I don't know, but I'm guessing they're babies who hatch. New moving eggs forever baby secret accessories. Hatchy babies have arrived. Oh, it is digital. They're really ugly. Okay, I'm sorry, kids. They're hatching eggs with interactive pet babies. So you get an egg, and then inside is a magical plush creature which hatches out of the speckled egg right before your eyes. Will it be a boy or a girl? You can feed, burp, tickle, and snuggle your hatchy baby and see how they respond. Teach your hatchy baby to talk and play games. Oh, it's a Tamagotchi. Once your hatchy baby hatches, reach into the egg to peel and reveal a high chair, plus four hidden accessories, a rattle hairbrush bottle, and cuddle buddy. Everything included. Including two AA batteries. You can't do batteries not included anymore. Otherwise, Christmas morning would just be sad because nobody'd be able to do anything. So hatchy babies were one of the top five purchases. And that's on Thanksgiving Day. It is, I think, all now that all the analytics are in with Cyber Monday and all that, it was the best holiday shopping season of all time. Sales coming from smartphones hit all-time highs. By the end of the week, $2 billion. Cyber Monday hit $8 billion, making it the largest shopping day, online shopping day of all time in the U.S. The largest ever. 20% increase year over year. Wow. Black Friday, $6.2 billion in revenue. November 24th and 25th set a record as the biggest online shopping weekend in the U.S., $6.4 billion. So I know what you were doing when you were listening to the show last weekend. You were shopping. 25% growth last weekend, year over year. So the full season this far, which is basically November, $58.5 billion in online sales, a 20% increase every day, generating over $1 billion. One big thing is Bopus. Oh, man. Geeks love acronyms, so do especially data geeks, right? BOPIS, B-O-P-I-S, that's buy online, pick up in store. A lot of people doing that. 50% increase year over year. Walmart and others were really pushing that, right? And I guess it helps you if you're a brick-and-mortar store because people can buy online and then at their convenience pop into the store, don't wait in line, don't have to worry about checking out or anything. Top sellers on Cyber Monday, besides the Nintendo Switch and Red Dead Redemption, little live pets. I'm thinking that's like hatchy babies. I'm thinking. Sounds the same. LG TVs. Drones were big. I thought drones aren't over, huh? Just for me, because I'm a bad drone dad. I keep driving my drones into the wall and losing them. And DJI, AirHogs, and Sky Viper, the top drone brands. Dell laptops. Big sellers. Dell had a big week. For real pets, again, I think this is a category. Little live pets, for real pets, and hatchy babies. For real pets. Whether it's for real dogs, cats, apps, or videos. Oh, boy. For real friends, get up and go-go, my walking pet pup. Plastic, imported, plush, electronic puppy that acts like a real dog and needs a significant number of C-cell batteries. Make sure you bring a little battery poop bag to carry around. That's from Hasbro. Walk her using her attached leash controller. These are all digital products. She sits when you pet the top of her head. She responds to your voice with sweet puppy sounds. She talks back and forth with her other fur real friends, Pom Pom, my baby panda, sold separately. And she's the star of course, the new Fur Real Friends app. There's an app for that. Yeah. I'm not having small children anymore. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to fight for the Beanie Baby in the store or the, you know, we should go through the years. The Tickle Me Elmos, remember that? What were those babies, the dolls that were so popular? Well, this year, get ready, little live pets, fur real pets, and hatchy babies are the big, big sellers. Well, congratulations to retailers because they had a good week. The magic hour of retail for because of online, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. 10 p.m. to 1 a.m., more than average, a full day during the year. Because people are, lying in bed on their phones? Get off. We got to get off the phones. Well, let's take a little tiny break. I'm going to get Kim Schaffer answering the phones here, our phone angel. And so give us a ring, 8888-ASK-LEO, and let's talk. You could fill me in on hatchy babies if you want. 8888-ASK-LEO, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This is now your theme song. I hate to say it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Big Pee-wee's whistling at the phone angel, Kim Schaffer.
I'm not going to complain about that.
Okay, good. I think some people would.
I'll take it while I can get it.
I think some people would, but I think that yes, good. We'll treat it as...
And I'm not sensitive and I'm not politically correct.
It's an honor. It's an honor to be Big Pee-wee's special, special person.
Yes.
Hello, Kim.
Good morning.
You've been slaving over a hot phone all morning, lining up wonderful callers for the program. Who should I start with today?
Wait, where's my screen?
Has it disappeared? I see Marcello, yeah, Jeff, Charles, yeah. Lynn.
Let's go with Marcello. He's looking at a specific TV, but he wants to know if now is a good time or should he wait?
Maybe
I think you asked yesterday. Scott yesterday, yeah. But I think his has... There's a reason why he's asking about the specific model.
I love to hear the stories. Thank you, Kim. Hello, Marcello. Welcome.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Just here listening to your show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And you're about to buy a TV. Is that it? You need a TV?
Yes. We're going to be moving soon to a new home, and I want to spruce up the new home with a new TV.
Nice way to spruce it up. And you have the spousal approval factor involved here.
Yes, definitely.
It's funny. Scott Wilkinson, he's the one who I think coined that spousal approval factor, SPF or SAF. And he's the one who said that in his research, guys wanted it big, women wanted it thin. So, but that's good news because nowadays TVs are big and thin. Tell me a little bit about your criteria. What are you looking for?
Well, right now I have four plasmas at home.
Okay.
I have two 65-inch.
Oh, you're well equipped. You want something better than that?
Yeah. So pretty much I want to jump into the 4K, yeah. But I'm not sure if I should do it now or wait for the new HDMI spec.
Oh, that's an interesting thing. Yeah, we were talking about that yesterday. So HDMI, current HDMI spec is 2.0. Next generation will be 2.1. The only real reason to wait would be if you wanted to buy an 8K TV, which I don't think I don't think you're contemplating, and I wouldn't recommend at this point. It's very expensive. It's too early. There's no content, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Scott was talking about 8K TVs sold by Sony and some other companies. The first 8K broadcast began this week in Japan, in NHK, but you can't get them anywhere else. And in order to watch them in Japan, you need a device that has four HDMI 2.0 connectors, and your TV has four ins because each one of those is a UHD signal, and the four of them together make one 8K signal. In other words, this is a couple of years off.
Got it. Okay.
I have to say, I was sitting last night watching a 4K HDR, by the way, is the most important part of that. Not just the 4K, but the high dynamic range. I was watching Altered Carbon on Netflix, which is not a great show, but is really beautifully shot in HDR 4K on an LG OLED TV. And I'm just blown away. The blacks and the whites, the difference between the darkest parts of the screen and the brightest is phenomenal. And they shot this show clearly trying to show off HDR. I was watching a scene where there's broad daylight coming through windows, very bright, almost hurts your eyes bright. And then there's in the corners dark stuff, and you see detail in both. It's just remarkable. So that's OLED, and that's the one thing better than what you already have, which is plasma. LCD, which is, you know, most common and less expensive, is everywhere. But you probably already notice a difference between your plasma screens and LCD screens, I would guess.
Oh, yeah. I can't stand LCD screens.
Yeah, plasmas. But nobody makes it anymore.
I've owned one before, and it just plasma won out, definitely.
Yeah. So nobody makes them anymore, but they have been replaced by OLED, not QLED, as Samsung's selling. Organic light emitting diodes. And these are not LCDs. The QLEDs are. These are not LCDs. These are direct view emissive technology that everybody agrees gives you the best possible picture, particularly when it comes to high dynamic range. So if you're looking for a good picture and high dynamic range, look at OLEDs. And while many companies make them, I think Scott recommends, and I have an LG. And I think the LG OLEDs are amazing. And, you know, the price is...
I was looking at the LG OLED 77-inch, the C8.
How much is that?
I'm looking at the website right now. It's about $7,000.
Yikes! But, hey, if you can spend that much, holy cow, is that a nice...
Yeah, so my wife and I are looking into that one, and we really want to get it. But, like I said, just not sure if we want to pull the trigger.
It's a lot of money. Everybody agrees that C8 is the best TV ever. The best OLED ever, the best TV ever. I don't remember which one, but Trusted Reviews says it's the best. I don't remember which one the shootout picked, but it is clearly, if you can afford it, the most amazing TV ever. Now, you can save money by getting a smaller one. You're getting, you know, the largest size. But hey,
go big or go home, you know?
Yeah, right. Right on, man. I mean, you're going to love this TV. And the size is great. People often buy too small a size TV, if you ask me. You can get this down, you know, cut it in half by getting a smaller screen. But if you want that big screen, I do not hesitate in saying that is the best TV currently, for anything under $100,000 on the market today. It's a gorgeous TV.
Okay.
And I like, you know, I'm not crazy. Go ahead. I'm not crazy about LG's smart TV features. So you're going to remember when you go 4K, you're going to upgrade everything, your AV receiver, your Apple TV or your Roku box or your Fire TV. You want 4K everywhere, your Chromecast. Otherwise, you're just wasting that beautiful screen. And the bigger the screen, the more 4K matters.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty much one of the reasons why we're going for that size.
Yeah. Oh, it looks good. You also will want to get, probably want to get, I don't know if you still buy discs, but you'll want to get a UHD Blu-ray player as well. That'll give you the best quality. Although, as I said, I was watching streaming Netflix, and I was sitting within 6 feet, I think, of my 65-inch LG OLED. And, man, did that look good. Watch, it's not a great show, but it's a great demonstration of HDR 4K. On Netflix, and it's free if you have Netflix Altered Carbon. Boy, does that look good. Leo Laporte, hey, have fun. The Tech Guy. Let's see. TV shootout. Let's see what won the shootout in 2018. The Sony A9F OLED won the value electronics shootout. So they looked at the 65-inch LG E8. I think the C8's a better deal. The Samsung QLED 75-inch, Sony's A9F OLED, and the Z9F LCD. OLEDs, of course, were the winners. The Sony scored marginally higher overall than the LG OLED. And the E8 and C8 panels are the same, so that's not... The LG OLED got 845 points. The Sony OLED got 850 points. So you're pretty darn close. And the LG OLED was ranked the very close in all of the. You can see this at the two the flat panels. HD.com news site, or just go to valuetvelectronics.com. Expert judges best HDR TV. Sony tied with LG. Sony slightly more color accurate. Tone mapping was better on the LG. Color gamut was better on the LG. Brightness was better on the Sony. Perceived sharpness slightly better on the Sony. They're pretty close. So I guess I'd add the Sony A9F. But I have to say that LG is amazing. I wonder what the pricing is versus... So the Sony A9F 65-inch is $4,147. And... No thanks. Thank you. And the LG 60... These are both 65s. Is $3,199. So the LG is considerably less expensive. And the Sony, it looks like, tops out at 65 inches. Well, so does... This is the E8. But again, I think that Scott has said the panels are the same in the E8 and the C8. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 88 Ask Leo. The phone number. I should, just to be fair, we were talking before the break about the best OLED TVs, and in the shootout, the Value Electronics shootout, they do this every year. They bring experts together to review the best, most expensive TVs. We were talking, I was talking with a caller about the LG. The E8 OLED was the one they reviewed. He was talking about the C8, but they're, I think, the same panel. Versus the Sony A9F OLED. And in the Value TV shootout, the A9F edged out the LG just by a hair. I think both would be very good. But if you, you know, and remember, when you're doing expert reviews, a slight difference. It's not, you know, this is an art more than a science. So I just want to give credit to Sony. They also have an OLED that this year won the Value Electronics shootout, the A9F. Either way, man, an OLED TV, oh, does that look good. It just looks so good, especially the HDR. That's more important than the 4K, although together you get a screen that just is mind-boggling. Jeff in Raleigh, North Carolina, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call. I've been watching you and been a fan since the call. Call for Help Day.
Oh, bless you. Thank you.
Talking to you.
That's been quite some time. We started Call for Help 20 years ago.
It's a great show.
Thank you.
That's what introduced me to the tech world.
I made you a geek, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
So I've got a question. I've heard you talk about the financial online software Mint in the past.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that, but it... You know, it seems like every day we hear about another database getting hacked or another company getting hacked, and I just wondered how safe it is. I lean toward Mint, but I know there's some other options like QuickBooks out there.
Yeah.
And but
so, by the way, QuickBooks and has an online version as well as a standalone version, and I don't. If most people use the online version, we do in our business office. So. To put this into perspective, we use Intuit's business bookkeeping software, QuickBooks, and it's got all of our data stored online. Mint, same issues from Intuit. It's an entirely online. There's no desktop version of Mint checkbook program that's suitable, I think, for consumers, for end users. It's what I use. In both cases, there's a risk, of course. Anytime you put anything online, there's always the risk. We just heard yesterday about the second largest data breach of all time. Marriott's Starwood booking system was hacked. Half a billion users' information revealed, including some pretty private information, in some cases credit card numbers, but passport numbers, addresses, phone numbers. So, and you know, and when you look at what Marriott was doing, clearly they were not paying attention to security at all. They have found out about this last week, but they said, but we believe that we were hacked. It began in 2014, 4 years ago. And even the most rudimentary security system has intrusion detection. Mine does, at home and at work, and will know if somebody's on your network. And so it's crazy that they didn't know that for 4 years, that hackers had the run of the place. So, and there's lots of other issues with the way they were keeping things secure. I believe Quicken is better than that. There has been no known breach of Quicken data. And now, thanks to the general data protection regulations in Europe, and I'm sure that European customers use QuickBooks and use Mint. I don't see any restriction on it. If there is a breach, companies, according to GDPR, have to tell the public within 72 hours of learning of it. That's why when Marriott found out about it last week, they told everybody right away there's a huge fine if they don't. So this is, I think, good news in the sense that if there is a breach, you'll at least know. If you're asking in particular about your banking credentials, I think that's the thing to worry about. I mean, it's one thing if somebody gets a look at your bank account. It's another thing entirely if they can log into your bank account, right?
Yeah.
And in order for you to use QuickBooks Online or Mint Online or any online checking service, you have to let them log into your bank account. That's how they pull the data. And I think, I trust that they used for a long time Mint and Intuit used a service, third-party service that the banks also use called Yodlee. They took it in-house some years ago. And, yeah, again, it's a matter of trust. Everything you do in computing is a matter of trust to some degree or other. I mean, you're trusting even if you use, let's say you use a desktop-only, no online component program, like Ka-Ching or something, even then you're trusting that that doesn't have a security flaw in it that's allowing a bad guy to get the information from your computer. There's always, computing is an act of trust, but so is driving down the road. You're trusting the guy coming the other way is not going to fall asleep and plow into you. So life is trust in the civilized society. Unless you're living out in the woods, you got to trust somebody. I trust Intuit, and as I said, our business, my business uses QuickBooks Online. So I trust Mint. I use it, and I have never heard of any breach or any issue coming around with that.
Would Mint be compatible to use two-factor authentication and LastPass?
Yes, they offer two-factor, and absolutely any service at all that offers two-factor, you should use it. So that protects that. Keeps a hacker from getting your credentials and logging in your Mint account, but it doesn't protect you because Mint and Intuit and QuickBooks and anything you use that logs into a bank account has your login information, has a token that allows them to get the login. Right. And I use two-factor on my bank as well, so that means it's kind of an extra step to get Mint to get into my bank, and I have to renew it every few months. That at least is good news. At least, it won't be permanent access to my account and all of that. If you use two-factor, you're still vulnerable to a breach of Quicken. So that's the problem, is that you can do everything you want. I mean, I'm sure if I had a Starwood account, I guess I did, if I had two-factor available, I would have used it. I certainly used LastPass and a long password. That protects you a little bit, because if the password to your Starwood account got out, at least, you could change it and two-factor to keep somebody from getting into it. But it doesn't protect you against the data that's stored by Starwood. And similarly, it wouldn't protect you against data stored by Intuit.
Okay.
Does that kind of make sense? What? So use multi-factor for sure, but it's not the be-all and end-all. It's not going to protect you against a data breach.
Right. And LastPass does work, you said.
Absolutely, yeah.
With those. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
One last quick question, if I may. In the past, one of your sponsors was ProXPN, and I've been a customer of theirs for a while. And have liked their service, but I wondered if they were still a good choice or
I think
if
so.
A better choice.
I think so. It makes me nervous when I see, and ProXPN does this, when I see them offering drastically discounted lifetime memberships. I think if you search around, you can find a ProXPN account for life for $15 or something like that. That's concerning because there's no way they can run that business profitably and do that. And with a VPN service, again, trust, right? Anything, any service you use online, You want to make sure that they're making money. Otherwise, they're tempted to maybe sell your information or, you know, do other things, put ads. VPN services have been known to put ads into the stream. I'm not saying ProXPN's doing that. I don't think they are. But I worry when I see deep discounts on a VPN service. I know we all want to get a deal. But sometimes it's too good to be true. And you want the companies that you're trusting, you want them to make money so they'll be incented to stay secure. Right?
Right. Right.
Right. So, yeah, I think ProXPN's fine. I would look and see. I don't know. I had only heard it's maybe not true that they were offering a $15 lifetime membership. I bet you there were other things involved that would get the money somehow. But I just – that made me a little bit nervous when I saw them deep discounting like
okay.
that. Yeah. That's, in fact, why we stopped doing their ads is I was worried about that. Okay. Hang on. We're going to take a break. When we come back – more of your calls, and I'll keep talking off the offline to you if you have more questions. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Okay, somebody in the chat room says it was a lifetime membership for $60, not $15. That worries me. When I see that, I don't care if it's $15 or $60. That worries me because 5 years from now, you know, I guess they're presuming that you won't use it for that long. I don't know. Yeah,
you have used the or still do use the tiny firewall.
I like that. Yeah, I think that's really good.
Thing essentially, right? It's a VPN.
Yeah, here's the advantage of the tiny hardware firewall. You're using a hardware device, so right there you're getting protection even if you don't use the VPN built into it. You don't have to. You can just use it as a travel router. But having that as a travel router is a great start because any attack goes to that, not to your computer. And they can't get into – there's things they can get from your computer if your computer's on the open Wi-Fi that they can't get from the travel router. So a travel router is a good start. And then the tiny hardware – so just use that. And then if you want even additional protection, they have built-in hardware VPN. They do something really interesting. This is a company called Hotspot VPN out of Washington Wi-Fi Consulting. I've known them for years. And they do each person has their own virtual VPN, which is kind of interesting. They run individual they call them black cloud servers for each individual. And then they also offer a Tor switch for anonymity. VPN does not offer anonymity. People sometimes think it does.
Right.
It does not. So having VPN plus Tor, of course, slows your surfing down. But if you really want a lot of anonymity, that's a nice feature. So, yeah, I still like them. And that's a good example of a company that I think is $100 a year. I mean, it's not free.
Right.
You know, you'll buy the hardware and the hardware is cheap. It's $50 or $60. There's a variety of hardware-based things at Tiny Hardware Firewall. But besides having that router feature, then you pay an additional $90 for the VPN.
Yeah. I travel quite a bit for my work, and I do carry a travel router with me. And I have trouble in the hotel rooms. It still makes you – I'm trying to remember all the –
It's the captive – I know what breaks travel routers, which is the captive portal stuff. And that's where you have to sign in through a page before you can use the Wi-Fi.
Exactly. Yeah. So am I still protected?
Yeah.
By my travel router?
Yeah. Okay. And Tiny Hardware VPN, Tiny Hardware Firewall works very well with captive portals. I wouldn't use it if it didn't, because everybody's a captive portal now.
Yeah.
Captive portals are a nightmare. They're the bane. I mean, they're a terrible thing, but there's no better way to do it apparently. But that's just a hack, a terrible hack.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Leo.
My pleasure.
Getting to talk to you.
Yeah.
After all these years, this is my first call, but been a fan for a long time, and I love your show.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you. Keep listening.
All right.
All right. Take care.
Thank you, Leo. All right.
Yeah, that privacytools.io is very good, I think. I remember looking at that. It's from somebody good, right? You know, you always want to consider the source when you get this kind of stuff. And remember that they're also incentive to take advertising for, you know, recommending stuff. But these guys don't. Yeah, I think these are good. Yeah. I think. I mean, again, you know, it's, you gotta there's a certain amount of trust. Yeah, yeah. Avoid all U.S. and U.K.-based services. These are hardcore privacy, guys. Give me two VPNs. Give me two VPNs more. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. Big Pee-wee. Damien's our musical director, doing a great job today. Our phone angel, the lovely and talented Kim Schaffer. I am your genial host, Leo Laporte. Somebody's mentioning in the chat room a great site. If you want to, if you're absolutely nuts, if you're crazy about privacy, if it's like, I want to be private, privacytools.io, it's going to scare you because it's very hardcore. And I would add to the things they say that if you're doing it online, you're doing it in public. Just remember that. No one ever got hurt by considering that if you're doing it online, you're doing it in public. However, the privacytools.io is for the hardcore, and I would say this is people like political dissidents who really need to keep, well, they need to be online, but they need to keep themselves private. I mean, I'll give you an example. One of the things they say at privacytools.io is if you are using a service in the U.S. or the United Kingdom, you're not private. Period. Do not use services based in the U.S. or the U.K. All right. Okay. So that gives you some idea. They do rate VPN providers with extra layers of privacy. So that's something else to pay attention to. And the big names that you probably have heard are on here. It's probably a good thing. And I'm violating the principle because the tiny hardware-based firewall that I use is from a U.S.-based company. Worse than that, they're in the D.C. area, so they're probably a branch of the NSA. And they use the tiny hardware firewalls they use are made in China. So probably I should stop recommending it, huh? Probably I'm highly compromised. But I'm not that worried about privacy. What am I doing? I'm doing a radio show right now, right? In public. No one ever went wrong by remembering if you're doing it online, you're doing it in public. Period. Charles Whittier, California. You're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Charles.
Hello. Thanks for talking to me. First off, I live in the tech dark ages, so please bear with me.
Well, you're the only safe one in this conversation then.
My wife listens to a lot of CDs and her CD player is dying, so I thought, you know, maybe we'll get something a little more current and get an MP3 player and figure out some place for her to download the music that she likes. And so that's what I wanted to ask you about.
Do you have a computer?
Yes, sir.
So you're right that physical media like CDs and DVDs are starting to fade away because it's so convenient once it's digital to listen to music. The one thing you could do if you have a computer is take all the CDs you own and do something called rip them, which is to convert them into digital form that's on your computer, and then you could put in an MP3 player. But I have to tell you, that will only bring you to about 2005. If you want to get into the late 2010s, you won't even do MP3s anymore. Most people these days do not buy music. They subscribe to streaming music services. And unless you have very eclectic music tastes, it's likely that everything you own now and everything you'll ever want to listen to is already on those services. The big names,
okay, but
the big names are Spotify and Apple Music. And, of course, you need an internet connection to use these. So that's the disadvantage.
Well, that'd be my concern for, like, when we're traveling that, you know, we don't always have cell phone, you know, contact,
yeah,
or, you know, that's where we get our Wi-Fi through.
Well, the way they handle that, and Apple Music, Spotify, those are the two biggest, Google Music's another one. The way they handle that is on your phone, you put their app, whichever one you want to subscribe to, and all of them are roughly the same price. They're around $10 a month, which is one CD, right, a month, or for a family plan, which includes five or six people, $15 a month. And the way they do that is you go into the app. I'll use Apple Music as an example. And you find an album you really like, you really want to listen to over and over again. And you can download it. You can download it to the phone and play it offline. You can download whole playlists. You can download thousands of songs and continue to play them just as if you owned the MP3s offline. The only difference is if you don't play the subscription fee, you'll no longer be able to play them. But okay. As long as you're a subscriber, you can have music, they call it caching or downloaded music, on your device that will work in an airplane or when you're in, you know, outside of the cell's coverage.
Okay.
And so that's the modern way to do it. If you a lot of people still like the idea of owning music. I mean, there's plenty of people right now shouting at me saying, physical media is not dead. People are buying vinyl records again. Well, yes, there are people buying vinyl records, but that's a small number of people. There are people still buying CDs. It's just this, it's bulky, it's inconvenient, it's hard to move around. An MP3 player, when Apple came out with the iPod in 2001, that was a revolution. And you could still buy iPods, and other companies like SanDisk make MP3 players that you can load up. You could take all the CDs she owns, you'd rip them on your computer. You can use, you know, there are a lot of programs to do that, all free. They can convert them to bits, put them on an iPod. If you're going to use an iPod, you'll use iTunes to rip them. If you're going to use the SanDisk player, you'll use some other program. There are a lot of CD. You could just Google CD rippers, and then put them on there.
Is there any difference between an iPod and a SanDisk as far as quality or any of that?
Not in terms of audio quality, no. In terms of hardware quality and usability, yes. The iPod really is the king of the hill for usability. And then, by the way, you won't be getting an iPod. What you'll really be getting, they call it an iPod Touch. That's the last one Apple still sells. And it's really just an iPhone without the phone part. It's got a screen and everything. They're for music playback, the easiest to use for sure. I'm surprised Apple still sells these, but they will for a little bit longer. You can get an iPod Touch. I'll tell you the base model price. I'm just going to look here. I haven't bought one in a while. In a variety of colors, $200 for 32 gigabytes. That's an awful lot of music. If you want to store four times as much, $300, they're cheap. It'll be like your phone, except it's, you know, it'll have all of her music on it because you'll have used iTunes to copy all that stuff to an iTunes library and then sync it up to the iPod Touch. It has a 4-inch display. It even runs many of the apps that iPhone runs. So you can even put her, you know, if she plays Candy Crush or something, you put that on there. But honestly, if you've already got a smartphone, you probably don't need the iPod Touch. You can do all of that with a smartphone as well.
Can you, like, download a menu structure so she can, like, pick a CD that she wants to listen to and pick what track off of that CD or play them all or whatever?
Yeah, all of them will do that, even the SanDiscs. A little less, a little more ugly, a little less useful. But, you can have playlists so she can pick all of her favorite songs in an order she wants or shuffle the playlist. You can look at the albums just like their albums. You can look at track by track. You play an individual track. Yeah, it looks just like an album. You know, one way to try this, try the free tier of Apple Music or Spotify on your phone, because you can use it for a couple of weeks for free and see if it suits. Most particularly, see if the music she likes is on there. It probably is. They have more than 20 million songs, but a few more obscure.
I'm sure it is. She's just into cowboy music.
Yeah, all the cowboy music's on there. You know, there might be a few Tex Wills and the Texas Playboys songs that aren't on there, but most of the cowboy music's on there. There might be a few things you're missing, but almost everything. If you like country music, it's all on there. And they have country music playlists. They have country music radio stations. Try it free for a week on your iPhone, on your smartphone. Doesn't have to be an iPhone, any phone, just to see. Because honestly, considering the convenience, $10 a month or $15 if you both want to use it. Is a great deal, and you can cache the stuff you like. You can say, I want to download 5,000 country songs on my phone, and you'll have them there, even if you're in the air. 88, Lefty Frizzell box set, sure they got it. 8888, ask Leo the phone number. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Tech Guy Podcast brought to you, as always, by those great folks at Quicken Loans who do Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage is designed for us, the geeks, the people who live and work online. We don't, if we're going to buy a house, that's too analog as it is. But the last thing I want to do to buy a house is go to the bank, get dressed up, go to a bank, fill out a paper form using a pen, and then, oh, worst case, and we did this last time we bought a house. It was 5 years ago, so maybe this was the state of the art back in 2013. We applied in August 2013, and we had to go find paperwork galore. They wanted us to, I kid you not, fax them bank statements, pay stubs. But the problem was the bank, and it was the big bank you all know, that used to be, by the way, the number one mortgage lender. When we did this, they were the number one mortgage lender in the country. And they took so long. We were on vacation. We were faxing stuff from a cruise ship. We had to call Lisa's sister, Debbie, to fax some stuff. It was just, we almost lost the house. It took them 2 months. So there was clearly a problem that needed to be solved, and that's where Quicken Loans jumped in. Now, there's a reason Quicken Loans is the number one mortgage lender, according to J.D. Power, in customer satisfaction. 9 years in a row. They just got 2018. There's a reason why they're the number one in customer satisfaction, not just in mortgage approval, but in mortgage servicing, because they put the customer first. And this is the first thing they got rid of. They created Rocket Mortgage to eliminate the trip to the bank, to eliminate the paperwork hunt, to eliminate the fax machine. Hallelujah. And by the way, a year ago, thanks to all of that, they finally eclipsed that big bank as the number one mortgage lender in the country. Coincidence? I think not. If you're going to buy a new home, you've got to check out rocketmortgage.com/techguy. And now what they call the power buying process is even better. I'll tell you what happens. You actually could put this on your phone. You can do it on the web. Do create an account, you know, before you go house hunting so that you're ready. As soon as you say, oh, yeah, we want to make an offer on this house, you can go to rocketmortgage.com/techguy, answer a few short questions, no big 20-page app, just a few short questions. They'll check your credit. They'll tell you what loans you qualify for. You choose the term, the rate, the down payment. Now you got, within usually less than 10 minutes, pre-qualified approval. Boom, boom, 10 minutes, not a day, a week, a month, 2 months, 10 minutes. Then step two, without, in most cases, without any intervention on your part, no trips to the attic or the archives, a loan officer will review your income, your assets, and your credit. And within 24 hours, they'll give you verified approval. Now you get a letter you could show the realtor that says they're good for it. It gives you the strength of a cash buyer, but it also clicks in their new exclusive rate shield approval. They lock your rate for up to 90 days. That gives you 3 months to shop without any concern about interest rates going up. And they are going up. So this could save you lots of money. If it takes a little time to find a house, that's fine. It should. This is the most important purchase you'll ever make. If rates go up, your rate stays the same. If they go down, your rate goes down. So either way, you win. This is exactly what you'd expect from America's best mortgage lender. RocketMortgage.com/TechGuy. Rate shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Their data is based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/TechGuy. And we thank him so much for their support of the Tech Guy Podcast. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk high tech. Computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. 888-827-5536. It's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, outside that area. Well, you can still call us. You just have to use Skype, some sort of voice over the internet to reach out. 888-ASK-LEO, still be free. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, coming up in half an hour to talk digital photography. But meanwhile, on with the show. I started a firestorm when I said earlier, we were talking to a caller who is living in the 1990s. He and his wife listen to CDs on the CD player. He says he wants to join the modern world. Now, at least they have smartphones. If you have a smartphone, you can skip a couple of decades and jump right into the present. He was thinking maybe to take the CDs and rip them or buy new music from Apple or somewhere and put them on an MP3 player. And that would jump you right up into the mid-2000s, where the iPod was king, right? Everybody had iPods. But even that, hard to believe, but even that has been surpassed now by streaming music services. And honestly, for almost everybody, unless you're an enthusiast. And now there are, I'm an enthusiast for some things. For instance, I just bought the Beatles. They reissued the 50th anniversary of the White Album. They did this last year with the Sgt. Pepper. And they have a very nice book, and it comes with completely remixed versions of the White Album by Giles Martin, who's the son of the Beatles' original producer, George Martin. And they're very nicely remixed. It also comes with, I think, 4 CDs of outtakes and earlier takes and demos and stuff. Stuff you've not heard before because the Beatles still have a lot of stuff in their vault. The sound quality on these probably isn't super good. I mean, they were recording them on tape. Although they took some care in recording it, it still is recorded with a, you know, 1960s technology. They've taken some care to remaster it, so it's as good as it can get. But, you know, it can't get better than the original. The tape, not, or maybe not much better than the original. Nevertheless, I bought it. I bought the CDs. I ripped them, which is a kind of a bad word for merely converting the physical disc to an on hard drive version. In both cases, CDs digital, hard drives digital. You're just taking the bits off the CD and putting them on your hard drive. And I did that. And I did it without further compressing them. I did it in a, you know, using a lossless codec. Apple has one called Apple Lossless. There's a more general one that's widely used by audiophiles called FLAC, and it gets all the bits that's on the CD. If you were to burn a CD from those files, they would be exactly bit for bit the same as the originals. So you want to do that, right? You don't want to reduce the quality by compressing them. So I'm now on there on my hard drive. If I want to listen to them, I have to sync them to a device, a phone, in most cases. Maybe an iPad, sometimes to another computer, and I can listen to them. I also might want to connect them to my cloud storage, because a lot of people do this. Google Music, Spotify, Apple Music, all offer, Amazon Music, all offer ways to connect your physical, or not physical, but your MP3/FLAC/AAC collection to the cloud. Apple calls it iTunes Match, so I use Match. All of those songs are either matched with their identical version in the cloud or uploaded if they don't have a copy. And then it's part of my Apple Music. I can stream it, listen to it from the cloud, or download it to a phone and listen to it that way. Now, if you're an audiophile, there's a number of problems with all of this. Most of the devices you're playing it back with don't have super high quality digital to analog converters. That's what a smartphone has to do. In order to play it back, it has to take the bits, turn it into analog audio. Actually, modern smartphones don't even do that, because iPhones, for instance, they don't have an analog audio jack. So, actually, I guess they do. Come to think of it, they do have a DAC in there, because when you connect the headphones to the iPhone through a Lightning to headphone adapter, it's not doing any work. It's just taking an analog stream out of the Lightning port. So I guess you're still getting an analog conversion, digital analog conversion inside the phone. Those DACs, they're okay. Actually, iPhones are fairly good, but they're not the best in the world. And that affects the quality if you're an audiophile. If you're an audiophile, you may not want the CD quality sound. Some audiophiles think CDs don't sound as good as the original. CDs are made by, and all digital music is made by sampling the original. So if you think, I mean, really all music, all voice, everything is sound waves, which is really variations in air pressure. My vocal cords modulate the air pressure, and it gets sent through the air to your ears, which actually sense the changes in air pressure, and your brain turns it into sound. It's kind of a magical process right there. That's all analog. How do you put that on a hard drive or download it or put it on a CD? Well, you have to sample it, which is to take the variations in air pressure, which looks like if you looked at it on a machine called an oscilloscope, it would look like just a wave. You've probably seen sound waves. That's a representation of the variations in air pressure. And all it does is it samples them by taking a measuring it at a given time, then measuring it again. And so if you think of it, how can I describe this? If you think of the waveform as a brick of cheese and the sampling mechanism as a cheese slicer, it's slicing that cheese up as thinly as it can and then saying, well, this slice is this big, this slice is this big, this slice is this big. It can store that numerically, digitally, on a hard drive, and more importantly, can then reconstruct that with a digital to analog converter into sound waves, into air pressure variations using a speaker. That's what a speaker does. It duplicates, you know, my vocal cords moving the air, or your violin moving the air. And so that has to be somehow triggered, and it's triggered by electrical impulses, which are analog impulses from the converted digital. So it's reconstituting those slices. CDs are pretty accurate. The measurements can be 16-bit, which means there's 65,000 possibilities. And they do that 44,100 times a second. So every 144,000, every 44,100ths of a second, it says, what does that wave look like right now? And it represents it as a number from 0 to, 65,535. It says, well, that was 43,227. That was 48,200. So it represents those. But you can, music, when it's recorded digitally, is often recorded at a higher resolution. Instead of 65,000, it's 2 million possibilities. That's 24-bit. It may also be sampled at a higher resolution. Instead of 44,000 times a second, 96,000 times a second. Or you could see we can really get in the weeds in this. And there are people with magical ears who say, oh, I can hear the difference. Oh, yeah, that was definitely, you can't hear the difference. I really don't think you can hear the difference. For a long time, I went out and bought high-res music. Certainly at my age, I can't hear the difference. And I have hearing that's pretty well attuned. You know, I've spent a lot of time listening to things, and I've been well-trained in what to listen for and compression. I can tell the difference between an MP3 and an uncompressed file, but it's pretty hard to tell the difference between a 16-bit and a 24-bit file. Nevertheless, these albums, digital albums, recorded that way. If you're going back to the Beatles and tape, well, forget it. It's not anywhere near that quality. So it'd be silly to buy a high-res version of a Beatles song. Bottom line, unless you're one of those magic-eared people, just subscribe to Apple Music or Spotify or Google Music or Amazon Music. You'll be much, much happier in the long run. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's my phone number. We're going to take a break, come back, talk a little bit more about tech, answer more of your calls. Don't forget the website. All of this will be there, techguylabs.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Chris.
Hello.
Where are you going for 3 months, dude?
No, 2 months. 2 months.
2 months.
Three.
Till March.
Months only. 6 weeks to New Zealand and 2 weeks to Norway.
Are these all photo workshops or just for
the
fun?
The first is an actual vacation.
In New Zealand, oh, how fun.
In New Zealand,
and a
yes.
Six-weeker. Wow.
Monica and I are, it's a bucket list thing, you know.
Oh, man, I'm jealous. Are you going to do a walkabout?
Of everything.
Nice.
We have tons of plans. So we're planning that out right now, finishing up all the bookings. And then in February, when the pretty much 3 days after I'm back, I have two photo-related things in Norway.
Are you going to stay in a hobbit hole? John wants to know.
Definitely. I'll grow hairy feet and everything. Yeah.
For sure.
So I'm totally happy over the next 4 weeks to do some pre-recording.
We'll just do a hiatus.
Time.
That's not. I'll just wait till you get back. That's ridiculous.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can still do stuff. I have no problem being present, if that helps you.
Well, I would just say enjoy your vacation, and when you get back, we'll resume.
If that's okay with you?
Yeah, of course.
All right.
I was telling John, there's no law, there's no contract that says there has to be a photo segment on the Tech Guy Show. So, well, if you're no problem. People won't forget you. They'll be very glad to have you back.
I think so. Sure.
Yeah. Good. That All sounds right. wonderful. And then a six-week workshop in Norway? No. You're going to do two in a row or three in a row.
Six weeks in January and then 2 weeks in...
I got it.
In February, and then I'll be back.
March 3rd.
March the 3rd, I'm here. Yep.
It'll be here before we know it.
Well, I know. That's what happens.
Yeah. No, that's fine. And we should probably tell Renee there won't be a assignment for a couple of months, but I don't have a problem with that at all.
I mean, I'll be here for the next 1, 2, 3, 4 Sundays, so we can do the next assignment right on the 30th, and then I will be... it'll be a 2-month assignment.
That's fine. We've done that before. That's fine.
Sure. Cool. Yeah.
Cool. All right, my friend. We'll talk in about 15.
Talk then.
Oh, I should mention, I did get your book.
Oh, did it arrive? Awesome.
I'm loving it. I'll give it a big plug during the show, and it ties in with my beautiful A9 and my F1.4 24mm.
That's perfect.
Oh, it's all I need. I swear.
70% of the pictures in the book have been taken at 24mm.
So gorgeous. I love it. The only difference is the tilt shift thing. I don't really need to do I know you love tilt shift, but I don't know.
Well, you know, I proposed that to the publisher. The publisher said, "Oh, we don't need tilt shift." And then I wrote the chapter and handed it in, and
they liked it.
They were like all over it.
It's the only way you can do this shot.
Well, it's worth having a look at least. It's worth kind of browsing through a bit. You might get the taste, you might not.
I'm so reluctant to buy a tilt shift lens, but you're right. I'll probably
No, you don't. Don't.
I'll probably use it. Cuz I do get even on 24mm, I get significant barrel distortion at the edges. So look at that. I love doing this stuff.
Oh yeah, that's multi-row totally
panorama.
Fun.
Yeah. So cool. Anyway, thank you.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it. I've been reading it. It's so much fun. Leo Laporte.
The Tech Guy.
8888 Ask Leo. Line 1, Joseph, Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hello, Joe. Mr. Joseph, Kalamazoo, you're on.
Hey, I have been a long-time listener.
Thank you.
I actually heard you guys mention the Bofang 888 radio on another show.
Oh, yeah. That was on our ham show. Yeah.
Actually, it was not on the ham show.
Oh, really?
They mentioned it was in some sort of gift guide.
Oh, neat.
And they mentioned that it was legal, and it's actually not legal unless you...
you got to be a ham.
It, so.
Yeah, or you got to be a ham.
Yeah, you have to be a ham, and you have to reprogram it because it comes with public safety channels on it.
Oh, that's not good. Oh, that's not good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a handheld, it looks like a walkie-talkie, and that's part of the problem is because it looks like a walkie-talkie, somebody might assume, oh, yeah, just turn this on and use it. But no, you have to have an amateur radio license, and I didn't realize this, but there are bands on there you're not allowed to use because they're for public safety.
Yeah, it actually has some public safety channels on there.
Yikes.
And it's really a bad idea to use that out of the box.
Do you remember what show it was they recommended it?
The new Screensavers 2 weeks ago.
Okay. I will...
Because I remember cringing.
I will correct it. Yeah, we have a lot of amateur radio enthusiasts watching and listening. I'm surprised you're the first to say anything about it. But I will... They're not FRS... They're not Citizens Band. They're not walkie-talkies. They're amateur radio. And actually, I do remember now our guest mentioning those, and I didn't realize that they weren't, in fact, licensed. Wow. These are made in China, and I guess those frequencies in China, either they don't care or they don't use the same frequencies.
Right.
They probably mostly they don't care. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Are they hard to program?
No, actually, it's very easy. I sent a link to the new Screensavers email address a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
To a private YouTube video on how to do it.
We'll do that in the new Screensavers on Saturday. I apologize to anybody who listened and bought these. They're not horribly expensive, so that was part of the reason probably that he recommended them. They're $23 for two of them. But you can't use them unless you have, because of the frequencies they use. They're protected frequencies for amateur radio, licensed amateur radio users, and some of the frequencies even licensed amateurs can't use because they're for public safety. But they are programmable. They come with a cable. If you have the cable, you can plug it in and you can use your computer. The pre-programmed frequencies are not legal. Wow.
Right.
Wow. Okay, that's good to know. Hey, I appreciate the call. And I apologize. I guess our producers missed your email, so I apologize. And I'm glad you called. Take care, Joseph.
Actually, I had another question.
Oh, yeah, go right ahead. I should mention, you can see these on Amazon. You can buy them. I guess you can buy them legally. It's just illegal to operate them.
Yeah, it's crazy how cheap they are and how illegal they are right out of the box.
Would the FCC, I guess, would they enforce? I mean, they only have a few of these cars they drive around that are looking for illegal broadcasts. I guess
it's actually the ham radio guys who do most of the enforcement.
That's who'll turn you in.
Usually you get a letter saying, hey, get off these frequencies. These are not legal to use. And then they'll call the FCC on you.
Wow. So don't go on there and go, hello, hello. A ham will bust you. So what can I do for you, Joseph?
I was actually curious if you knew any way to turn off active noise cancellation on an Android phone. For some reason, it picks up my voice and makes me sound like I'm not actually talking.
You're the thing it's canceling.
Yep.
Wow. Which phone? I don't think this is a necessary. This is part of Android. I think it might be part of that. Of some hardware, particular hardware. Whose phone are you using?
I'm using a Moto X4, which I really love, other than it's not a really great phone for phone calls, apparently.
For you, anyway. because what happens is they put in these phones, and you're a ham, so you'll understand this, they put additional microphones to pick up background noise, and they use that for canceling. But if it's not well implemented, so that's why it's hardware specific as opposed to Android specific. But if it's not well implemented, how bad could that get? Let me see if they, you would think that they, okay, so I'm looking at some old stuff that says the setting is under somewhere you would never look, call settings, voice privacy.
Really?
Well, this is a fairly old posting from 2010, so. But that's roughly the X4's. Well, X4 is a little bit newer than that, but that's for, I guess, an older Moto. Anyway, look and see if there is something under privacy of all voice privacy of all things. I guess they consider that voice cancellation to be a privacy feature.
Looking? I'm not seeing it.
You don't see it. I'll have to keep looking and see if there's any. Yeah, Motorola says, well, you should submit your device for repair. Apparently, you're not alone. I'm seeing a lot of people saying the voice quality, and this is awful. Yeah.
I actually fixed it by just getting a little piece of foam, cutting it apart, and then I have a big case that covers over that part.
Yeah, just cover.
And I just stuffed a piece of foam in
it. Kill that noise-canceling microphone and use the regular one. I wonder if you use a headset, it probably doesn't have any problem either, right?
Yeah, in my car, I have no problem using it.
Yeah.
Then also on Zello, which is a radio app.
Oh, interesting.
I have no problem with it either.
Oh, interesting. So that's sad. then I'm also seeing, and again, this is old. I doubt this is still relevant. There's a Moto Speak app that might let you do that as well. So
Moto Speak app?
Yeah, I bet you that's long gone. What I'm seeing here is a lot of people don't like this active noise cancellation. And so I think you've got the right solution. Tape over the mic, the second mic. Wow. Guess it wasn't well implemented. Oops. Get one of those Bao Feng things. They probably did it right. Isn't that funny?
Oh, yeah. I have a couple of those.
Do you? Yeah. At that, $23 for a pair. The reason I remember this is when they were recommending it, I couldn't believe the price. I thought that's got to be wrong, but no, they're cheap. These are. Do you think they're probably just software defined radios in a little computer box?
I actually worked at a radio repair store, and we opened some up to figure out what they are. And they actually have a lot of circuitry that would look like a software defined radio, but it is.
It's a real radio.
Analog radio.
How interesting. Joe, a pleasure to talk to you. 73. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's talk photography next. Oh, I forgot to mention. I probably should mention this right now. This is so timely. Our sponsor, Prylock Security. When I read about the Marriott hack, I have to think about it and say, you know, almost certainly, the way that the bad guys got into the Marriott reservation system was through a phishing email, what they call a spear phishing attack aimed at a company, carefully crafted by a hacker so that an employee of the company would open it and then basically let the hacker in. Could have been social engineering, actually. Could have been somebody calling up, pretending to be a customer. Could have been something called a candy drop, which I didn't know about, but I learned about from Prylock Security. A candy drop is when bad guys sprinkle infected USB drives in the parking lot at a company. Employee goes, oh, look, somebody dropped a 64 gig USB drive. Awesome. Puts it in the computer. Bam. Without their knowledge, it's infected. Somebody mailed me a USB drive the other day. I thought, probably shouldn't use this. But I've taken the Prylock Security training. You should too. 91% of all successful hacks start with a phishing email. If you don't train your employees, your hackers will, and you won't like the result. Prylock Security is a best-of-breed security training platform that does so much to protect your business. I'm sure you and your IT department have done a great job with all the firewalls and, you know, filters and so forth, but the weak link's always the employees. So here's how Prylock works. And by the way, very affordable and easy to set up. You don't have to have an IT professional to do it. With one click, you can set up a full year's training for 50 to 5,000 employees. Take you less than a minute. What you get, first you get a three-day baseline test where they send phishing emails to the employees and record what they do. So you can see without the training how vulnerable you are. Then you get a custom user page for every employee that's loaded with important resources, targeted, designed for that employee's specific weakness, right? Because it's not their fault. You know, they need to be educated to be paranoid, frankly. Most people are nice. Then you do the security awareness training, and I did it and I loved it. Taught by a hacker. Actually, it starts out nice and nice, ladies teaching it, and then a hacker hacks it, takes over. And the point of it is, it's fun, it's gamified, but the point of it is to not give you a list of do's and don'ts, but to teach your employees how hackers think, the psychology, why they do what they do, and how they manipulate you to get the job done. At the end, there's a 10-question final assessment that's for compliance mandates. And then, it's not over, because then Prylock Security schedules and runs 24 additional random phishing tests throughout the year. You and your employees, and you'll get these too, will get these what look like emails, but they're phishing emails. Fortunately, they don't go back to a hacker. They go back to Prylock, and it automatically enrolls people who click into specific training videos if they do it too often. So it helps reinforce it, and it keeps people on their toes. You get analytics in real time 24/7. If you're more experienced or you're an IT professional, you can use their library of 600 of the most effective phishing training emails or customize your own. It's really good. It's on the psychology. It's got the phishing tests, for instance, include they opened the email, they clicked a link, they downloaded an attachment, they enabled macros. You know, so you'll download a file and then it says you need to enable macros for this Word document. Or even they entered data for credential theft. These are all the things employees can do that can mess you up bad, man. There's even a nice feature called Send a Friend a Fish, which lets your users send friends or colleagues phishing emails. And then when they click on it, a learning page to show what they missed. I got one. It was pretty funny. Henry sent me one. Prylock offers one-year security programs, companies as small as 25 employees for $395. They've got a system that makes it very affordable for them. They pass the savings on to you. And you might want to go to Prylock.com, Prylock.com/twit, because they also offer single license gift cards for the parent or friend or family member that always falls for this stuff, right? If you've got a family member, we had an email yesterday from somebody whose aunt continually falls for these things. You can give them a single license gift card. It'll give them, test them two phishing emails a month for a year. And honestly, it really helps. Look, you can't learn all the ways that hackers are going to con and trick you, but Prilock Security will show your employees the psychology that's being used against them and give them the information they need so that they and you are not the next victim. Learn more at prilock.com/twit, PRILOCK.com/twit. You'll save 30% if you use my name, Leo, as the promo code, so that's a really good deal. prilock.com/twit. If you own a company and you haven't trained your employees, you are vulnerable. Prilock.com/twit. We thank him so much for the support of the Tech Guy podcast. Mama don't tell me, go to Chrome. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. It's that time. I hear that music. I know. Chris Markwart's here. And Chris, I want to, hello, our photo guy.
Hello.
DiscoverTheTopFloor.com. I want to give him a very big plug. I just got your new book from Rocky Nook. Wide-angle photography, capturing landscape, portraits, street, and architectural photographs, all four of which I love doing, with wide-angle lenses. And there's a whole chapter on tilt-shift lenses, which you've talked about before. And honestly, this to me, this is the sweet spot. I just, as you know, decided to just use a fixed 24-millimeter lens on my Sony Alpha camera. And I love the pictures I'm getting. And this book is a great
inspiration.
Wide-angle
is fun.
It is fun.
It is, isn't it?
So thank you.
It changes your way to look at the world around you because you have more stuff in the frame. You have to find ways to get everything kind of nicely in the frame. It's a bit more difficult than a longer lens, and that's what I'm trying to do in the book.
To
cover in the book.
That's one of the first challenges you do, and you do talk about it because you're bringing in so much of the world around you. And by the way, camera phones are wide angle. Most of them are roughly 28 millimeter. So you get a lot more of the world. So you have to think about that and simplify the picture by either moving around or just considering the framing, because otherwise it could be too busy. On the other hand, if I love street photography, and it's really great for getting the scene, right?
So it's great for getting the scene. It also kind of forces you to get a bit closer because with a wide angle lens,
yeah,
things are just further away. So you have to get closer and you have to be more in people's faces, which makes it, again, a bit harder, especially if you're kind of used to capture pictures of people from further away. But
well, it's a good challenge for me because I'm a chicken. And so my street photography has all been with a long telephoto lens far, far away. But it doesn't have that. I don't know what it is. You kind of talk about it in the book. But it doesn't have the immediacy.
It's not as in your face.
Yeah. So going in there and getting that picture, yeah, it's a little more challenging for me because I'm kind of shy. But it's good. It's a good discipline. I'm really enjoying it. Anyway, thank you. Thanks for the book. Can people get this book if they go to discoverthetopfloor.com?
It's in the bookstores. It's on Amazon. Oh. It's probably in your local Barnes & Noble.
Wide Angle Photography, Chris Markwart. Yep. What do you want to talk about today?
Well, I want to take us a bit outside of the everyday photography and more into scientific photography.
Oh.
And the reason is about a month ago, I spent a day at the Rochester Institute of Technology at the RIT. And one of their associate professors, Ted Kinsman, is in their photographic arts and science department. And he teaches students, among many different things, many other things. He teaches them high-speed photography. And we've all seen these shots, like the bullet going through an apple or a balloon popping, things that are fast. And Leo, you can bring up some video on the side if you want to.
Yes.
TFTTF.com/RIT, a friend of mine, filmed, and we put some videos online.
This is when you were in Rochester at the Rochester
Institute. This is when I was in Rochester.
Technology.
Yeah. And this all goes back to a guy from MIT, Harold Edgerton. He invented the electronic flash, and he started to use the flash as a shutter. So imagine you turn off the light, you open the camera shutter, and then you trip the flash, and the flash is pretty much what takes the picture, right? So you replace that mechanical thing in your camera with a burst of short burst of light. And that makes things interesting because a flash is shorter than your camera shutter. Your camera shutter, even in a good DSLR, doesn't go much shorter than a 4,000th or an 8,000th of a second. That's just what they do. But a flash, it's fairly easy even at home to get like a 20,000th of a second or a 40,000th of a second. So you can use that to freeze motion. And we did this at RIT. We did this. We did like a balloon pop experiment in the class there. I actually sat in as a student in that introductory class, which was a ton of fun to experiment with things. You can also use this to get these, like, you know, these water drips where you have the rebound of the water drip coming up and you catch that right in mid motion or shattering glass. One thing Harold Edgerton back then did, you might have seen these pictures of nuclear explosions.
Oh, yeah.
Like, really, really, yeah. like a few milliseconds into that atomic bomb going off. Edgerton developed a special shutter that could be open for only 10 nanoseconds. That's a 10 billionth of a second, which is really, really interesting. And then if you want, for example, what we did is we did that balloon pop experiment. You trigger that flash using a microphone. So the moment you pop that balloon in the dark, the microphone picks up the sound of the balloon, and then it turns the flash on for 20,000.
And that's fast enough?
And that's fast enough, and the result is incredible. That short burst of light.
By the way, it looks like it dazzled your eyes.
I'll tell you why. I mean, the resulting picture is coming up in a second here on the video. So what you do, because that is a really fast bit of motion.
That's a great picture.
But what you do is you put a little bit of water in the balloon, just a few drops, and then you have a saturated, humid environment in there under pressure. And the moment the balloon pops, that turns into fog, but just briefly, just for like a fraction of a second. So if you manage to catch that moment of the balloon popping with a bit of water in it at the right time, you get this effect where you have the half pop balloon and the other half is this mist of water. And it's just magical.
So I always thought, this must be a super fast shutter speed. But you can do this with a normal camera.
You can do this with pretty much any camera that has what's called bulb mode. So you put the camera on a tripod, you rig everything up so that the pop of the balloon trips the flash.
That's the trick. You need this microphone and off camera.
You need something
to trigger
yeah. that strobe, and then you turn off the light in the room. You open the shutter in bulb mode so it stays open, and then that brief burst of light that happens when the balloon pops, that exposes your picture, and then you close the shutter again, and you have the shot.
Now, did they tell you, or are you just such a trained professional that you knew that you should not only make a face but keep your eyes wide open?
Oh, I this is not the first time I've done shots like that. So it was pretty obvious what I knew what I wanted.
Because the temptation would be to blink, of course.
Yeah. But then I'm also not a fast blinker. Some people blink faster. Some people have faster reflexes. I only ended up with a wet face from the water in the balloon. But yeah, that was cool, and we saw a lot of things. There's a whole bunch of videos I put up there, not just about the balloon pop. There's there's like an introduction into how a scanning electron microscope works, because that is a different kind of photography. We're talking about a fun experiment where you drop Scrabble letters in front of your face and expose them with a flash, so you have a word written hovering in the air without having to use Photoshop. There's a ton of interesting stuff in there. So anyone who has a bit of a nerd gene, it's definitely worth watching those. Lots
if
of cool
you go
there.
To tipsfromthetopfloor.com, it's right there on the front page, including that image of Chris popping the
there.
Balloon. And I'm sure more information about what kind of gear you'd need. What is our photo assignment this week?
The current assignment is still Ring.
Ring.
ring it is.
Don't know what that means. Could be ring a bell, could be ring on a finger, could be ringing in the new year. You have to figure that out. Take a picture, uploading it to Flickr, use the tag ring, and then post it to the Tech Guy group. Our moderator, Renee Silverman, will thank you. And in a few weeks, Chris will review. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Liam.
Tips from thetopfloor.com, discoverthetopfloor.com, and the new book. Don't forget it. Wide angle photography. Nice. Very fun.
Thank you. That's the problem.
I would need some pretty hefty equipment to do. I want to do this, especially the Scrabble.
The Scrabble thing, that's a little trapdoor with a little solenoid. You can buy those. and then all you need is an Arduino that trips the solenoid and then trips the flash after a predetermined
amount of time. Do you have all the details on what you would need to do?
Not really. But there's tons of stuff online. I would love to be able to just link to something.
It would be such a fun project, especially because an Arduino is involved.
Okay,
to do with our teenager.
They love doing that. I mean, programming the Arduino. If you've done that before, that's like a 10-minute program. You know, it's easy to write. You just need to listen to the microphone and then have a variable with milliseconds in there, after which you trip the flash.
What's amazing is that the sound is fast enough to trigger the flash that you still get the balloon in mid-destruction.
It works quite well. And you can adjust the timing by just moving the microphone.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. A mic would have to be pretty close to the balloon.
This one was maybe a foot away. So if we do the math, I don't know how fast.
Oh, this would be a good project because then we'd have to do the math.
A bit of meteorology with the fog in the balloon.
Oh, yeah.
A bit of everything. It's a very interdisciplinary project.
It's a science class in itself.
Very cool, yeah.
Oh, what fun.
So that's what they do to teach students the scientific thinking of how to make this work and how to get the camera to do the work for you.
So it wasn't a photography class.
It was a beginner's, it was an entry-level high-speed photography class,
okay.
But, of course, the students have to learn, like, how this works,
all
how
you
can use the flash as a shutter and all these things. So,
wow, that's wild.
Lots of fun there. It was an exciting day to be there, and I'm very glad that my friend John was with me, and he filmed the whole thing.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
You the best.
A
few more weeks before you go away.
Yeah, I'll be here until the end of the year.
Nice. Thanks,
right.
Chris. See ya.
Talk to you next Sunday.
Bye. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. I'd love to hear from you if you want to talk high tech. Another hour to come on the show. Let's get back to the phones. Line 4, Mel in Anchorage, Alaska. Mel, you okay?
I'm fine. I was in Tampa when the earthquake hit.
So, of course, you're fine. Even though it was a fairly large earthquake, I guess it wouldn't get all the way to Tampa.
No.
How's your house?
We're having two structural engineers come tomorrow to evaluate it. But I think it's just minor cracks in almost every room in the drywall.
Wow. So are you sorry you weren't there, or are you happy you weren't there?
Well, I don't know. It was super scary, according to the people that I have talked with.
Yeah, very strong earthquake, a 7 magnitude.
Yeah.
The earthquake that damaged San Francisco so badly in 89 was only a 6.8. 7 is very strong.
Yeah. Most of the cabinets were emptied onto the floor, a lot of broken glass, not in the house, but in dishes and stuff like that.
So you're flying back, you flew back just to check on things and then you'll go back to Florida? Or
no, I was on my way when I heard about it and had to wait, or I elected to wait in Tampa to make sure the airport was open before I left.
You guys have big earthquakes there. I didn't realize the 64 earthquake was 9.2.
Absolutely,
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm glad everything's safe and sound. That's good news. At least for you.
Just a lot of damage.
Yeah, I mean, the pictures we're seeing from the earthquake are terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely.
What can I do to help you?
Well, I have a dilemma. I want to buy my grandson, who's a junior in high school, a computer, which when the grandkids have graduated, I have always upgraded them to a Mac.
Oh, aren't you good? And what a nice grandpa.
Yeah.
Holy cow. Not just the new computer, but the cream of the crop.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I don't know anything, because I've been an Apple person for many years. I don't know anything about the new processors and so forth, and I'd like to spend somewhere around $400 or less, if possible. But this computer I will then pass on to a great-grandchild when we replace it with a Mac. So I want something that's going to be good for 4 or 5 years.
I see. So this is the interim computer until they get the nice one when they graduate.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a low budget, probably indicating the best thing to do would be to get a Chromebook as opposed to a Windows machine. Of course, you know, there's no Mac at that price. The cheapest Mac out there is $1,000, as you know.
Yeah, right.
There are Windows machines in the $200 to $400 price range, but they're pretty junky. Remember netbooks? Well, remember when that was a fit thing? You know, the cheap. And that almost killed the Windows ecosystem because they were so junky.
Yeah, and I'm not set at $400. I want a computer that's going to.
But it's just a 2-year computer. I understand. You don't want to spend so much money because you're going to replace it eventually.
Yeah, a 2-year computer for him, and then we'll go to one of the great grandkids.
Yeah. It kind of depends on what he needs it for. Most schoolwork, in fact, most schools now use Chromebooks. Most schoolwork could be done on Chromebooks. Chromebook is not great for, a lot of kids don't want it because you can't play Minecraft or Fortnite on it. But in a way, that makes it a good school computer. You can certainly get work done. Anything you can do in a Chrome browser, you can do on it, which means email, research. You can write on it because, of course, it works with Google Drive, which has a full Office suite on it. Word processor, spreadsheet, presentation tool. If the school says, no, you got to have PowerPoint and Microsoft Word, well, this wouldn't necessarily be a very good choice. Although there are online versions of both of the entire Microsoft Office suite that he can use. I'm a fan of the Chromebooks. They're secure, they're inexpensive, and they're pretty robust. My daughter's in college and uses a Chromebook, and she used to use MacBooks, and I said, oh, I can get you a MacBook. She said, no, I love my Chromebook. She doesn't want, and I think this is not unusual. It's interesting with kids these days. They don't want anything too expensive because then they feel guilty if it gets damaged or stolen. So I think, have you spoken with him about a Chromebook, whether a Chromebook would be suitable?
No, I haven't talked to him at all because if it's going to be a...
It's a surprise.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you probably it's unlikely to anybody... would open a Chromebook on Christmas morning and say, oh, I've always wanted this. Unfortunately, it doesn't have that sexy factor, and yet it's probably, from a practical point of view, a very good choice. I would look at a Samsung Chromebook Plus or a Chromebook Pro. That's what my daughter uses. I think they're really, and they're in that price range. They're very good. The Pro uses Intel chips. The Plus uses ARM chips. I don't know that the Pro is any faster. It's just some people want an Intel chip. She uses a Chromebook Plus, and it's fine. The Pro is $500. The Plus is about 100, maybe 150 less. So that's a good start. It's a touch screen. It comes with a pen. It's actually, I think, really practical for a student.
Well, good.
Yeah.
That gives me some place to start because I had no idea.
Yeah. I'm a big fan. They're secure. They require online, but if he's in school, I'm sure he has online at school and at home.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, and they're really, I think, highly functional, and they're less of a temptation, frankly, for a kid to screw around because you can't. And honestly, kids at that age often get malware because they download stuff from suspect sites and so forth. And so a Chromebook is a really good, I think a very, very good choice for a student. Asus makes good ones as well, A-S-U-S, A-C-E-R. Almost all the manufacturers of Windows machines make very good Chromebooks as well. And they generally are, you know, a few hundred dollars less than a Windows machine. They're not buying Windows, for one thing. Chrome OS is free.
Good.
Okay?
Good. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening. I'm glad you and yours are okay.
Yeah, you bet.
Thanks for that direct report from Anchorage. Wow. Friday, we're sitting in a meeting, and the news came across, and it was just, wow. Wow. 7.0 earthquake. That is strong. Nothing we've experienced here in California, at least not in my lifetime. Google services are good. A lot of schools use it. If he's in high school, I know sometimes people get mad at me when I say Chrome OS, and I'll be honest, I was really skeptical. I had a long conversation with Sundar Pichai, not when he was CEO of Google, but back when he was running the Chrome OS division, when the first Chromebooks went out. I said, Sundar, I don't get who this is for. Any computer can be Chrome. But what I really underestimated the value of having a simpler computer, a computer that isn't a general purpose computational device. It doesn't do everything under the sun. When you do that, your security is much more difficult to maintain because it means you can also run malware. It means that it's a lot less reliable because you can run everything under the sun. That makes it a little bit less reliable. I really feel like a Chromebook is a very good choice for a lot of people who think they need Windows or Mac. It's touchscreen in many cases, runs Android software in many cases. I wouldn't spend $1,000 on a Chromebook, but for that price range, $300-$400, that's a great device. I guess this would be a good time to mention our sponsor. Actually, come to think of it, Brex. This is a charge card for startups, basically. A credit card for startups is what we use as a corporate card now because it's got so many convenience features. It's the first corporate credit card for startups. It takes you 5 minutes to set it up. It's an online application. Underwriting is not based on your credit. It's based on cash in your bank account. And Brex can offer you 10 to 20 time higher limits than other corporate credit cards. And I really appreciate this as a small business owner, no personal liability required. So a lot of times with a small business or a startup, the credit card companies say, all right, but the company's not liable, you are. No, that's why I created an LLC. I don't want to be responsible. I'm not going to skip out on it, but I don't want to be responsible. Well, you're not with Brex. Brex is based totally on the cash in your accounts. And by the way, great value rewards. Very high. It's multipliers on services you as a business spend the most money on. 7x on ride sharing. 3x on travel and restaurants. 2x on software. There's no limit on how many points you can earn. Points can be redeemed for statement credit as well on the transactions. So you just want cash? Fine. Exclusive offers with some of the best technology brands out there, too, like AWS and Google, Salesforce, WeWork, the stuff you're using. If you're a startup or a small business or an individual business, this is the credit card that does exactly what you want it to do. They underwrite your company. They're not underwriting you. That means there's no minimum operating history required. A lot of startups, hey, we're brand new. There's no painful paper application. You know me. I don't like those. And no personal liability requirement. Brex uses the cash raised by your business to extend credit. Doesn't require a credit score. Doesn't require a social security number. Doesn't even require a security deposit. It's a Visa card powered by the Visa network, so everybody takes it. You can instantly issue cards to employees, set limits, control spend, virtual cards as well as physical cards. In fact, you get instant access to online virtual cards, and then they mail the physical credit cards. It came like a day later. It came right away. Every employee can have a corporate card with real-time limits that can be adjusted by an administrator. I actually really appreciate that. Some of our more trusted employees, they have higher limits. New guys, they don't get as much. But it's good for them to have a corporate credit card because when they're making transactions on our behalf, oh, I love this. First time I use it, we go out to dinner, Lisa and I. And I charge it on the Brex card. I get a text from Breck says, you just charged it. Take a picture of the receipt. What? Okay. So I'm literally still at the meal. So I take a picture of the receipt. It says, yeah, we've matched it up. It's in. It's done. It's automatically matched. And then in the statement, you get a complete description of what you've spent money on. I just think it's so great. Integrates with all your major accounting programs. It's just a clever idea. Join the thousands of startups and tech companies who use Brex, B-R-E-X, to manage their growing business needs and, I like this, earn valuable rewards while doing so. Get the card free. Twit listeners will get Brex card fees waived forever when you go to brex.com/twit. No card fees forever when you go to Brex, brex.com/twit. It's just, you know what it is? It's a 21st century credit card for business, for startups. It's all done right. Brex.com/twit. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We've got smartphones. We've got smartwatches. We got all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. It's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, outside that area. You can still reach us. Just use Skype and it'll still be free. 8888-ASK-LEO. There is a website, and anything that we talk about on the show ends up there. Your questions, my sermons, all at techguylabs.com, and those are free. That's free. There's no entry fee, no sign up, nothing like that. It's like the web used to be. You go to a website and just use it. Techguylabs.com. See, I'm the tech guy, and it's my laboratory. So the techguylabs.com, and we've got all 1,500 and some shows in there now. So there's audio and video from the shows. There's comments. There's also, by the way, you can leave comments. So if you've got a, you know, you're listening to the show and you say, wait a minute, Leo, you can't recommend that. You can absolutely go there and put that in there too. TechGuyLabs.com. Line three is Micah in Maine. Hey, Micah, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk with you, Leo. And I got a question for you. I can't figure out what happened yesterday. You got to tell me.
Uh-oh. What happened yesterday?
Well, I hate Spectrum. I mean, there's every good reason to hate Spectrum.
Spectrum is the old Time Warner internet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I quit them. I went over the top, and everything was great. But, you know, I made a deal with the devil, and I ended up coming back because they offered me a price instead of getting more than what I was getting before.
Yeah, of course.
For $70 less.
These cable companies are so smart. They're so smart. Okay, yeah. What happened then?
Keep you on. Anyway, I wanted to keep my own modem, which I did because I was always with them. But the deal included that I had to get their phone. So I need to put that in their phone modem. So they put that in, too. And I say, nope, you got to keep my modem for the internet. I'm not using your modem, which they did. In the meantime, I got my router, and I was using an older router, an old Netgear N300 router. It was working fine before they arrived, and they killed it.
Yeah.
Working, couldn't get anything to work.
Yeah.
So they said, it's your router. It's bad. I said, no problem. I happen to have a brand new D-Link, old Xfinity Extreme router, a DR600, pulled it out of the box, brand new, never used, unpacked it, plugged it in, dead, nothing. Can't believe it. They said, nope, your router's too old. It's not going to work with this. I'll prove it to you. So they go outside, and they get their own router, and they plug it in. Works just fine.
Of course it does.
I'm going to go down to, I'm going to go down to Staples. I'm going to get myself my own router. I'm not using yours because you're going to broadcast it to everybody and interfere with my bandwidth. He said, I can't wait, but it should be fine. So the good news is I went down to Staples and I got myself a Netgear Nighthawk AC2300.
Very nice.
It's great.
Yep.
I love it.
Nice router.
Perfect for my little apartment.
Good.
But why did my two routers that was working just fine with the same modem before they came, why would they both have died?
When you say died, you mean they don't turn on now? The lights don't come on? Nothing happens? Or they just don't work?
Lights turn on. Everything's good.
Oh.
But they're not receiving the signal from the same modem. When he plugs it into his test modem,
right.
You know, to check the lines, everything's fine. Plugs it into the router, it's no good, although everything's fine on the other end.
So it's hard for me to say exactly what's wrong, but there are a number of things that could happen. Remember that these cable companies are now using a new protocol called DOCSIS, D-O-C-S-I-S 3, and it could be that you have a modem that is DOCSIS 2, and they've turned off the switch at their office that works with DOCSIS 2 modem. So that's one possibility, is that they now require, it may well be, and in fact, if you go to the Spectrum webpage, they'll tell you what modems that they support, and they may well require DOCSIS 3. It's also possible.
My modem was fine. It was just the router that went bad.
Remember,
my modem is still working.
No, yeah, but, I see what you're saying. The modem's fine. It's the router.
Both routers went out.
And the router, okay. Okay, and it's the modem that you had before, not the...
Yep, it's my own TP-Link.
Okay. And he didn't mind that, but he did have to split the cable because he also has a phone modem on there so that you can get phone service, which you can ignore, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah, and generally what they want you to do is use a single modem that does both, but he reluctantly but did set that up for you, and that's interesting. So coming out of the TP-Link, you have an Ethernet jack, is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
That was going into my older router, the old Netgear router, and was working just fine before he...
So Ethernet's going into the router, and have you... And so when you connect it... almost certainly what's happening, and it could be shenanigans on their part, they will record the MAC address of that router and the MAC address of the cable modem. And in some cases, I've seen cable providers do this. When a new MAC address is attached, they won't work with it. They'll say, no. You have to use the old one. Now, you say you're using the router that worked previously, right? So they did know about that MAC address.
The router that used previously that they didn't know about, yes, I was using that. I was using it up until the time he came and just added the other modem.
Okay, and that router doesn't work either?
That router doesn't work.
Because they do know about that MAC address. They had that in the approved list. So that's a puzzlement. It is not at all uncommon. And if, by the way, there are ways to get it working, sometimes just unplugging the cable modem. In other words, shutting the whole system down, waiting a minute or two, and reconnecting everything.
We did that many times.
And it didn't help.
We went through that. Didn't make it.
Then the other thing, and he could have done this if it was a MAC address issue, is called the office and said, I'm adding equipment with this MAC address. Please add it to the approved list.
Yep,
but what he did that.
Yep. He was great. He was here for 3 hours. He really worked on it. And it wasn't a contractor. It was a real Time Warner tech that worked with a technical service supervisor. He was absolutely puzzled. He couldn't figure it out. He was working with me as best he could. And he couldn't come up with an answer either.
That's quite a puzzlement.
The router that was working before wasn't working. The new router that I pulled out wasn't working. And, you know, granted, I spent $180 and I got a new, Nighthawk router, which works just fine, and I'm happy with it. But I can't figure out why I had to spend $180 for seemingly no reason.
That's interesting. So the Nighthawk is working fine. It's just the two older ones that didn't. A router's a router. Ethernet's Ethernet. There's no way that those routers are incompatible.
Right, and both of them were showing that it was not picking up the internet. The light would not come on, showing that it was getting an internet signal from the modem.
Yeah, that means, and without any changes in configuration or even power cycling the modem, you were able to connect the Nighthawk, and it worked fine.
No problem, right out of the box.
Huh. That is quite a mystery. That is quite a mystery.
Don't you just love Spectrum?
I don't know if it's their fault. That's what's interesting. So, I guess if I really wanted to track this mystery down, I would say take those old routers and see if they worked in other environments. Because it does sound, honestly, it doesn't sound like they're doing MAC address blocking because you were able to attach a new Nighthawk and it worked just fine. So, it didn't. This is a new. So, the MAC address, just for people who are listening, is a unique identifier. Everything that goes on the network has to have a MAC address that is unique. The address is composed of, at the beginning part, the number of the manufacturer, and then in the end part, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hexadecimal numbers. At the last three are unique to that device, It's a unique identifier, and some cable companies will look at the MAC address, because every device has to broadcast one, and say, oh, no, we don't know that. Who's that? That's not one of ours. And you can either reset it or tell them that this is my new thing. But that's not what's going on here, because that new ASUS router, they'd never seen that before. That had a unique MAC address never before seen, and they didn't block it. So the only thing I could think of is somehow, for some reason, those two old routers were broken. I can't think of anything that would happen unless it's, it might be. Is it IPv6? Is it an IPv6 issue? Boy, you got me. This is a mystery. Our chat room is going to chew on it. We'll make this the mystery of the week, chat room, and see if you can solve Micah's problem. Great to talk to you, Micah. I don't have an answer for you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Anybody think about Micah's problem. What could possibly be going wrong? He didn't even see an internet link light on those modems. What could be going wrong? We'll talk about it when we get back. Woo! Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo, this portion of the Tech Guy Show brought to you by the amazing Epson Fast Photo Scanner. Preserve what's priceless with the new Epson Fast Photo. It's the world's fastest personal photo scanner in its class. Personal photo scanner in its class. Easily restore, save, organize, and share your memories with the Epson Fast Photo. On we go with the show. Charles, Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hello, Charles.
Hello, Leo.
Hello,
thanks
Charles.
For taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
You helped me out a lot a couple weeks ago. I was getting a Mac Mini and took your recommendation on the Dell monitor. And it was a great choice.
So oh, good. You. Did you get the curved one? Which one did you get?
No, this U27-inch. Got a great deal through Costco, actually.
Nice.
Really good price. With everything, you know, all the fees and taxes came out to about $420.
Very nice.
So it was a great deal.
Good.
So just thank you for the help there.
My pleasure. That's a nice setup. Those new Mac Minis, a nice big 27-inch monitor. That is a great setup.
Yeah, and savings there helped me kind of boost to really kind of my high end on the actual Mac Mini. So
good.
That was a...
You basically have an iMac without paying for an iMac.
Basically.
Yeah.
And the Epson printer, I'll put a plug-in for there, was definitely a good choice, too.
Good.
So
thank you.
Definitely want to say thank you all there. People are out shopping, definitely looking at all the options, like Costco. Even Costco had good deals, too. So
they have a great return policy, too. That's one reason to go to a big-box store, is the return policies are usually very generous.
Yes, they are. A quick question for you, follow up on setting everything up. And I had some older hard drives, but when 5 terabyte drives, but trying to set up Time Machine with you know, going from, I think I set them up under El Capitan, but with the new OS Mavericks, what's a good way to set up Time Machine? Should I do a separate partition on the hard drives, or what's a good way to, I don't want to screw up the data on my, everything is backed up on there. So
you're on Mojave, not Maverick, right?
Right. I'm in Mojave. Yes, sorry.
Yes. You know, one of the things that did happen when they moved to this new file system, APFS, is issues started to show up with backup solutions like Mojave. You'd think Apple would make sure that that the Time Machine worked just fine with Mojave. My recommendation, for a long time, APFS did not work with Time Machine, and you had to use an external drive formatted under the old HFS file system.
Right.
So that would be, I don't know if they fixed that. I bet it's still a little flaky. The truth is Time Machine should be completely rewritten under APFS because it has a snapshot feature that would be a far better way of doing what Time Machine does than the current Time Machine. The current Time Machine is a kludgy piece of junk that uses hard SIM links instead of, I mean, it's just a bad idea. However, I use it too. But if you're going to use it on an external drive, not an internal drive. Because remember, this is there in case the drive dies. So use it. Don't use it on the drive inside the Mac Mini. One of the advantages have with the Mac Mini is all those extra ports. You can get a relatively inexpensive, even a USB 3.1 drive with a Type-C cable. And make sure it's formatted HFS. Don't format it APFS, because I'm still not sure Time Machine is that reliable with APFS. And then that's what I do, and I have it just kind of sitting there chugging along. And the advantage of, I always think of Time Machine as not my primary backup strategy. For me, Time Machine is really versioning information. It's useful for going back to a previous version of a document. So I'm editing, I'm writing a little article or something, and I realize I've just made a hash of it. I don't want to do any of those changes. I moved all those paragraphs, and I can go back to the previous version using Time Machine. That's a huge value, and that's the only thing I would use it for. Even if you're using Time Machine, you should still make backups. You should make image backups of the entire drive. I use Super Duper. Love it. Use Super Duper. Have a Super Duper drive always connected to your Mac Mini. Have Super Duper run every night and update it. That'll give you an external bootable drive. So if the internal drive on the Mac Mini dies, you reboot the machine, hold down the Option key, boot to the Super Duper drive, and it's exactly the same. You're working just fine. It won't be quite as fast, but you're not out of luck. So that's the other thing I would do. And then, of course, you want a third backup, which is an offsite backup. And I'll leave it to you to figure out how to do that, Carbonite or something like that. I say if you're going to set up Time Machine, do it on an external drive using HFS Plus.
That's what I have is these external Seagate 5-terabyte drives. And I think I'm not having right now. I think they were under HFS. I just didn't know. I remember you talking about there being versioning issues, you know, between the structure. So, okay, no, that is helped me out a lot.
Yeah. And, eventually Time Machine should be updated so that it uses APFS. And then it will be – then I will not hesitate recommending it because it will be a much more reliable system. The APFS is a modern file system that does – it's a what they call a copy-on-write or COW file system that does snapshots, and that's what Time Machine's trying to fake. But if it did it for real, it would really be great. So I think in time – it's just – you know, Apple – APFS is still, in my opinion, beta. It's not done. Apple's still working on it. I don't know if they've even enabled snapshots yet, so – but it's going to be there. I know a lot of people with Mojave had trouble with Time Machine. I think as long as you use it on an HFS Plus disk that's external, you're probably all right. I still use mine. Now, one thing to worry about or watch out for, Mojave, in previous versions of Mac OS, external drives would never be formatted APFS. Now it will. So just be careful not to reformat that Time Machine drive to APFS. Keep using HFS Plus.
All right. Okay, that's what I was going to know. All right, appreciate the help there.
Hey, no problem. Yes, thanks.
Thanks for all the help.
All right, you have a good one. Enjoy your new Mac. I think those new Mac Minis actually are pretty sweet. I just need an excuse to buy one. I have far too many computers. I guess I can't justify it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Ask Leo, let's get back to the phones. Don't forget, website techguylabs.com. If you missed a part of the show or you don't hear a show at all, you can always go back there. Audio and video of all of our previous shows. Actually, we don't have video for some of the really early shows, but you can go back and listen to audio to the very first Tech Guy show. We're coming up on the anniversary of that. It was, I think, January 3rd, 2004. It'll be 15 years ago in a couple of weeks. And then shortly thereafter, we went to CES 2004. If you want to hear what tech was like 15 years ago, kids, what your parents were using, you can go back. That's how long we've been doing this, 15 years. In tech time, that's like 100. That's like a century. 8888-ASK-LEO, techguylabs.com. On we go with the show, line two, Bob in Lisbon, Connecticut. Hello, Bob.
Yes, good afternoon to you, Mr. Laporte. How are you doing, sir?
I am very well, sir. How are you?
Not too bad. I have a question, obviously.
Well, sometimes people have a statement, so it's good. Yeah, it's good to know you have a question, yeah. Usually the statement is, you're wrong, Leo, and I want to tell you why.
Yes. I used to use Yahoo at one time.
Yes.
I haven't used them in years. In fact, for a long time, I used Gmail and still have. I'll be getting away from those guys. But anyway, I punched up on Yahoo, probably got 3,000 emails in there. And so I was going to dump them once I read their oath policy. But how do I, through that, transfer all those emails? I don't want all of them, but at the very beginning, there's contacts there.
I would get them all. Why not? Easy to do. And then you can delete them at your leisure. Or just, you know, right. I mean, honestly, drive space is so cheap nowadays. Bandwidth is so plentiful. Why not get them all and just put them in a corner of the hard drive? That way something comes up and you go, oh, yeah, that problem. This happens to me all the time. I always regret deleting email. I'm looking for emails from 2007, and I know I have them, but at one point I must have gone through and deleted old emails. If you have the space, keep them. So here's the way you get them. Obviously, Yahoo is a web-based email system, so normally what you do is you go to mail.yahoo.
By the way, sir, our computer died, so I need to transfer it somehow to my or one of my droids. 64 gigs.
Okay. You got, honestly, 3,000 messages probably is just a few hundred megabytes at most.
Right.
At most. So the trick is on this is you're going to need a mail client that can download messages. On Android, you might want to look at a mail client called K9, like the dog.
Okay, K9.
Not C-A-N-I-N-E, but the letter K-N-I-N-E. It's a very powerful mail program that you can get on the Google Play Store. It's a little more powerful than the one that comes with it. And it's open source, so I don't think it costs any money. But what you're going to want to do then with K9 is set it up for the Yahoo account. And set up the Yahoo account as a pop mail account. So you might have to go, let me just get this, see if Yahoo offers those settings. You have to get some special settings from Yahoo or Oath or whatever the heck they call themselves to use pop mail. And that way you can download, K9 will download all the messages. That's how pop works. That's an older protocol. You remember those days where you'd get your email and it would delete it from the server. That was in the days when hard drives were not cheap and plentiful, and so the mail provider didn't want to store your old emails, so you were expected to download them. So it's pop. I mean, I'm looking at it online. You'll probably want to look at it online. pop.mail.yahoo.com on port 995. You'll be logging in. It'll download all the copies into that email program, K9, and then you can go through them, look at them, read them on your droid, delete them at your leisure. Just remember, when you're deleting them, because you're going to delete everything on the Yahoo Mail as well, I presume.
Yeah, no, I'm going to dump Yahoo, and a friend of mine who's an ex-military cyber expert said after that, he said, do you want to wash your phone?
Okay. He's, you know, the problem with these guys is they certainly aren't wrong, but they might be a little more paranoid than the average Joe.
He's the one who turned me up to Proton Mail. I'm going to be using
that. Oh, that's great. Yeah. So Proton Mail is very private. All the mail is encrypted. And whether this is good or not is up to you. Their email servers are deep inside a Swiss mountain.
Right. I heard about it. Yes. And they burn it. You have a choice. They give you like 1 minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever. And within so many hours, you know, boom, it's just burnt, gone. So there's no, and generally if they get anything from the NSA or whatever government, they just give them, as we used to call the military, the one thing.
They ignore it, yeah. Because they're in Switzerland, you know, they don't have to pay attention. So, you know, if you were going to Gmail or something else, there are ways to do this on Gmail. But if you want a local copy of your email on your Android phone, then I would just use K9 and have set it up as a pop mail server. You can, in the checkboxes, delete mail after downloading, and that'll save you some time. It'll delete the mail automatically from Yahoo. But I'd still go in a week or two later and make sure Yahoo actually did delete it.
Okay, now the problem is that obviously to enter Yahoo, I have to accept their oath promise.
That's all right. You can accept it, then delete it. I mean,
You can.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I was worried about that because I mean, it's nothing criminal, but I've gotten to the point now where I want to get away from Google.
I don't blame you.
I'm going to start using Firefox which I used years ago, for years and years on my Motorola. I'm a strictly Motorola fanatic, you know.
There's two reasons people care about privacy. One is they're up to no good, and they really, or they, you know. But the other reason is on principle. And I think it's completely legitimate to say, look, I'm not doing anything wrong. There's nothing, I have nothing to hide. But on principle, I don't want the government or companies snooping around in my stuff. It's my stuff. I close the door in the bathroom when I go in there, and I'm going to close the door on my email. I don't want them looking in.
Yeah, well, it's that, and also, you know, the browser. I mean, there's also a start page other than Netherlands.
Well, there's you can go on and on in this. It's just an endless process. It sounds like you've got somebody in Black Ops who is assisting you. I would, you know, just remember, he's more paranoid than the average bear. But if you don't, you know, it's a fun game to play, and I think it's not a bad signal to send to governments and corporations that we don't want them snooping on us. Now, understand that there's a certain amount of snooping that that they use to pay for your free service. So your Yahoo Mail or your Gmail, your Google Mail, those are free. Facebook is free. It costs some money. I would say a considerable amount of money. To serve you, and the way they make that money is with advertising, and the way they make that advertising valuable is by selling your demographic information. They don't say, you know, Facebook is not, as far as we know, saying, oh, you know, that Bob from Lisbon, he's 53 years old, and he's married with two kids. They're not doing that, but they're saying to an advertiser, if you want to buy people in Connecticut between the ages of 50 and 60 who have a family, we can sell you that, and then they'll throw your, you know, account into that batch. But as far as we know, advertisers are not getting the specific information about you. Nevertheless, I don't think it's a bad thing at all to send a signal to these companies and send a signal to government that, no, we want to keep this stuff private. And for people who say to me, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, you shouldn't worry about privacy, I close the door on the bathroom when I go in there. If you do that, then you do care about privacy. You know, there's times when you just don't want somebody peeking in over your shoulder. And I think it's perfectly appropriate to say to a company, no, I care about this stuff. I'm going to use services that are private. They'll usually cost you money, but, you know, there you go. So Proton Mail is an interesting story. I'm really tempted to mock them. I know they're trying their best. You know, and that their heart's in the right place. But by being in Switzerland does not guarantee anything. Putting their servers in a mountain doesn't guarantee anything. If your this so-called end-to-end encryption is not really end-to-end encryption, because the encryption is automatic. Now, they say that means we can't read your email. That's a good start. But it doesn't mean your email is private, because if you're sending it on a smartphone or a computer and that's compromised, the email is compromised. I mean, there's a lot to be said for this. Honestly, I think end-to-end encryption is critical, but you can do that yourself without involving a third party. I think involving a third party in your end-to-end encryption makes me a little bit nervous. But, you know, it's a good idea. If you're going to use, let's put it this way, if you're going to want to use webmail, then a service like Proton Mail is probably the right way to do it, because webmail has all sorts of security issues. Now, it's not free, but that's good. You don't want it to be free. If it's free, they're making money somehow, and it's probably by violating your privacy. So, you know, anything that's free is not either. They're incredibly generous. Oh, it is free. Well, they do. You know, truth is, it's free unless you want to pay for it. And if you want advanced features, that's a lot of services. Freemium, I guess, is what you should call it. And then it's €4 a month. You get more storage. You can send more messages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But so it's nice that they're offering a free tier. What do you get with a free tier? 150 messages a day, 500 megabytes. That's pretty good. You'll go through 500 megabytes pretty quick. But you don't want to store your mail on their servers anyway. Yeah, it's not expensive. And they claim a huge number of users. I think 5 million users. So, you know, if 5%, typically 5% pay for a freemium product. So that means if they have 5 million users, that means 250,000 are paying. So that means that they're making €1 million a month. That's good money. That's probably enough to pay for all this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Proton Mail, which our last caller mentioned, is an interesting company. They offer free email that's end-to-end encrypted, they say. Although you're, you know, as with anything, you're trusting them to have a good system, using JavaScript, I presume, to do the encryption. It stores it in a server in the Swiss mountains. I don't know if that's better than a server in downtown Geneva, but okay, fine. I mean, it's not impervious to nuclear attack, but who cares if it is or not? And they only store a small amount, 500 megabytes for the free version. But again, if you're using a private email service, you probably don't want to store mail there for very long. So Proton Mail is not a bad solution. They have a paid tier for €4 a month, which is what, about $5, $6 a month. That's not bad. They claim 5 million users. And I just did a little back of the envelope math, because typically if something's free, with a paid tier, you can count on about 5% of the users to pay for it. Yeah, it's that low. We're cheap. So they're making probably about €1 million a month if 5% of their 5 million users are paying for it. It's not a big business, but it's, you know, it's probably viable. And you might say, well, what do you care if it's viable? You do care. You do care, because if a company is not making money, they're going to find a way to pay for those servers, and it's generally going to involve violating your privacy. So it's important. If you're trying to use a service that's private, you got to figure out, well, why is this free? A lot of this is open source software that's created by people who believe in this and who give away their programming time. There's a lot of open source software. That's good stuff. That's good stuff. I use, for my email, I encrypt my email and sign my email with an open source program that's free called GNU Privacy Guard. And I trust it because it's open source. It means anybody can look at the code and see what they're doing. And it's free, and it's created by privacy advocates over the last 20 years who really want to make sure people have the opportunity to encrypt their email. There's another solution called Signal, which is a messaging program. Same story. It's free, but it's created by Moxie Marlinspike and his friends, and designed from the ground up to be secure and open source. That's really important, open source. I would not trust any solution that isn't open source, because that means there's no one can look at what they're doing. And that's important. I mean, if it's not open source, the NSA could have a back door. The CIA could have a back door. The only way to be sure that something's doing what it says it's doing is by looking at the source code, or in most cases, since you and I aren't, you know, probably sophisticated programmers, that somebody at least is looking at that source code and making sure it does what it says it'll do. On we go to line four, Ken in Glendale, California. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Leo. I'm trying to start my CPA practice, and I need to buy a computer, and I need your help. Which computer usually accountants buy, and which one is the best for accounting business?
Well, my wife, who is a financial type, CFO type, she's actually the CEO of my company, but longtime comptroller, used Windows for many years, and almost always business types use Windows. I convinced her to move to a Mac, to her great regret, a few years ago. She likes the Mac. Now I'm saying, you know, you could use Windows. Windows 10 is pretty good. And she said, no, I already moved once. I'm not moving again. But the reason that's the case is because nowadays most people aren't using applications running on the operating system to do bookkeeping. They're doing online stuff like QuickBooks, which really doesn't care what operating system you're using. This is actually the way the world is moving. It used to matter. Mac versus PC, Android versus iOS used to make a difference. But as we do more and more stuff in the cloud, through browsers, it doesn't matter what operating system you're using. So if you're going out and getting a computer, I would say save money, get a Windows machine. If you're using standalone accounting apps, almost all of those are on Windows, and it'll work just as well in the cloud as anything else will. So I would say go get an inexpensive Dell. If you want to look the part of a bookkeeper, when you go into somebody's office and you're doing accounting and you want to look the part, get a Lenovo ThinkPad because they look utilitarian and serious. In fact, I would say this to any professional. You don't want to give the impression that you're playing games. You want to give the impression this is a serious business computer. Get a black ThinkPad. And everybody will know you're serious. And by the way, they're really, really good, solid computers with great keyboards. You're probably, there's one issue for you is that you're going to want a number pad because you do a lot of data entry. And a keyboard without a number pad is a real pain in the butt. That's going to limit laptops quite a bit for you. But there is a ThinkPad with a number pad. I wouldn't buy it only because it looks off center. The trackpad's not in the middle anymore. It's weird. But on the other hand, that's less important if you're doing bookkeeping than a number pad. You need a number pad. Don't get one of those Asus Republica gamer laptops. They won't take you seriously. Get a Dell. Those are pretty boring and very nice, well-made computers. I really love the – in fact, if you want to get yourself a nice computer and still look businesslike, get one of the Dell XPS laptops. But honestly, if I were doing bookkeeping, I would get a ThinkPad. And I would get one with a keypad, with a numeric keypad. It's a little bit wider, 15-inch. You get lots of space to look at spreadsheets, and you get the data entries a lot easier. Good luck in your new career, Ken. That's awesome. Frank from Southern California, welcome.
Hi, Leo. Love your show.
Thank you, Frank.
So it's synchronicity. You were just talking about the Lenovo. My wife just recently retired from Kaiser Permanente.
Yeah.
And she's getting back into real estate.
Yeah.
And needed a Windows machine.
Good choice.
Picked up a Lenovo 15-inch IdeaPad.
Ah, now notice I said ThinkPad.
Right. I got an IdeaPad for $400 from a big box store.
Yeah.
i5 processor.
Yeah.
What a deal.
No kidding.
Absolutely. She can do everything. She can put all the programs she needs with her real estate company on there and run it.
So that the one thing I would say is that most companies, certainly Lenovo does this, have a consumer line, which is much less expensive, and a professional line, which is more expensive. Generally, the professional line will be better made, better screens, not faster processors necessarily or bigger hard drives. They'll just be physically more robust. And so when I recommend Lenovo's, I almost always say, get a ThinkPad. Yes, they're more expensive, but they're going to last longer. On the other hand, if price is an object, and these days, when is it not an object? Lots of companies make very good prices. Windows PCs have gotten so cheap. Just remember that there's going to be a sacrifice on a cheaper computer in something, the trackpad, the screen, the keyboard, something, and not necessarily the processor or the hard drive size. So Acer makes some very inexpensive stuff. Dell does. Of course, there's the inexpensive Lenovo's. Just understand, you know, you get what you pay for. And if you're getting an amazing price on a Windows PC, they're giving up something. They're using less expensive components at some point. If you want a computer that's going to last as long as possible and be as free from errors as possible, I think you need to spend a little bit more. That's what I buy is ThinkPads. On the other hand, I think Lenovo makes some really great consumer tablets and laptops. I've used many of them, and I think they're very good. So I'm glad your wife's happy. That's good news. Thank you, Frank. Thank you all for joining us. Thanks to Big Pee-wee, Damien, our musical director, for spinning the discs. Thanks to our switchboard operator, Kim Schaffer, for plugging you in, and thanks to all of you for listening. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security and Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on. and on. And of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.